I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and our colleagues at American Public Media have created Call to Mind, an initiative to help foster new conversations about mental health. When they talked with us about doing an episode on mental health issues and food, I'll be honest, I wasn't sure about it. I was afraid I'd say something wrong, or I just don't want to offend anyone living with a mental illness, or just make things worse, you know? And then I realized something. And that's, if we were just avoiding the conversation because it'd be hard, or frankly because I was afraid of talking about it, we'd just be part of the problem. We'd be helping to keep these issues in the dark. So here we are with this episode. We tried to put it together with humility. We might make some mistakes. We know we don't know how to fix things, though we will point the way to some information or counseling resources for people who want them. But what we really felt was important was just to listen, to hear from people telling their own stories. We want to respect those stories and just be grateful to our guests for sharing a piece of themselves. And they give us a lot to think about. They showed us their pain and their hope, and yeah, they made us laugh a little too. So in this show, we'll listen to Stephanie Covington Armstrong, who tells us about living with eating disorders and the particular experience of living with them as a Black woman. We'll listen to Virgie Tovar, who tells us the mental health implications of fat phobia and diet culture go well beyond those of us with disordered eating. And we start with a conversation about substance use disorder and excess, something that affects so many people, but especially in the restaurant and hospitality industry. It's an industry we hold dear because it's where we celebrate our good times and it's where we indulge to release our stress, but it's also one that's filled with people who deal with anxiety and substance use. Dave McMillan is one of the owners of Joe Beef restaurant in Montreal, a legendary palace of food and drink. He realized, after years of running the place, that he was dealing with something serious in himself, and he's here to talk with us about his journey to sobriety. Dave, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, for pretty much as long as I can remember, in the food world, the story has always been, hey, if you want to go party, if like you really want to go to party, go to Montreal and go to Joe Beef, right? Like the reputation you guys have had for good times is legendary. So maybe let's start there. What do you feel guests saw or still see when they come to the restaurant?
Well, you know, first, it's kind of like a way that we practice the restaurant business in Montreal. There's a very cold climate cabin culture and a certain French-Canadian hospitality that is of Quebec, right, that we are brought up in, that we understand to practice the restaurant business in, right? Joe Beef is a special occasion, festive restaurant, that doesn't take itself too seriously, where we cook very good food, and we like to celebrate life. So that means aperitif, that means champagne, that means white wine out of magnums, that means red wine out of magnums, it means cheese before dessert, it means dishes for two or for four, duck for four, rabbit for two, and shared appetizers, just cover the table with food, foie gras, truffles, all of those things. Calvados at the end of your meal before we send you home. All of those things, right?
And, I mean, that sounds amazing. I want to
be
there right now.
We practice bistro French cooking and, you know, in a celebratory way.
Yeah. But you also say that you built the restaurant on your liver and that, you know, you at some point took in that scene, were a part of that scene, made that scene, but that it started to affect you in a way maybe different than some of the guests. Tell me about that.
Everything was fine for many, many years. Of course, I apprenticed under, you know, great great chefs that lived the wine and food lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I lived the wine and food lifestyle. When I traveled, it was to go to other restaurants. When I wasn't in restaurants, I was visiting vineyards and wineries and distilleries. And it went really well till it didn't. I just felt like alcohol was a constant. My life, being David McMillan of Joe Beef, the social pressure of having chefs from all over the world visiting the restaurant and wanting to partake in this legendary, you know, Joe Beef experience, mm-hmm. became daily for me, right? Yeah. It became it when I went to the lake up north with my neighbors. It became that way when I received family over in my private home. It became that way every night at the restaurant. So then I would realize that I lived a grandiose eating and drinking lifestyle 7 days a week, you know, 28 days a month, 364 days a year. I drank wine and ate rich every day to mm-hmm. the point where I was no longer interested somewhat in the rich foods of the world. So there wasn't a wine that I found interesting anymore, right? Mm. And I'd been drinking some of the finest wines in the world. I got to a place where I was no longer happy, where I had trouble breaking away from my daily life of being David McMillan of Joe Beef.
Yeah. So it's, you know, suddenly you weren't a person, you were a persona. And
correct,
suddenly,
right? I used to turn the show on. I lived a very private life. I'm an introvert during the day, you mm-hmm. know. I focus on business. I spend a lot of time alone in an office. I spend quality time with my family, my children. But then around 4 o'clock, you know, one of my wine bars opens at 3 and it's quite busy. So, you know, 3 o'clock, all the wine kids show up at the wine bar and the tasting of wine would begin at 3. And then at 6 o'clock, more people show up at the restaurant next door, Joe Beef. And my other restaurant fills up at 6:30, Liverpool House next door. So then I'm hopping from one restaurant to the other. I've got glasses of wine on 20 tables. I'm telling stories. I'm entertaining. And there's always someone. There's always a chef from New York. There's always a winemaker from the Loire Valley. There's always another chef from Chicago coming tomorrow. There's always one of my peers coming, right? There's always someone to entertain. There's mm-hmm. always someone that I have to put the show on. Even if I didn't feel like it, it just became like, this is how I earn my living. Yeah. I get paid by being this legendary tavern keeper who celebrates life with everyone, right? Yeah. And I was, you know, and I was getting to a point where I'd assumed that role, that I was going to be this unhealthy Orson Welles type chef who eats and drinks himself to death and was going to be carried out on my shield like Bacchus, right. You know? But it just became unsustainable. I didn't enjoy the restaurant business anymore. I didn't enjoy the act of cooking. I didn't enjoy wines. I didn't enjoy, you know, I built a kind of a cool company with my associates. I blamed the company, you know, for my misery. I just got into a dark place that I could no longer see joy in.
Yeah.
Right.
At some point you thought you really had a problem.
Yeah, I'd seen a friend of mine, Ryan Gray, who owns a restaurant called Elena, who'd worked with me for a decade. We drank together famously running the restaurants, right? He got sober a couple of years before I did. And, you know, at first I was like, ooh, he scared me, right? He knew something I didn't, mm-hmm. right? He had information that I should get, but I wasn't ready to get yet.
Sure.
But, you know, one thing led to another. I felt that the people around me just started realizing that I was kind of caught in a trap, but that I was going out like on the shield, like for the people.
Yeah.
And a couple of the managers in the restaurants got together and they called a friend of mine who actually was, you know, a famous interventionist. And they just intervened me one day, one morning. They said, listen, we feel like you're not happy. We found you this help. It's local. We'd love you to go there. You seem unhappy. You seem in a rut. will you take the help that we're offering you? And I said, yeah, you know what? Absolutely. Because I'd been to the point where I'd kind of Googled stop drinking a few times, or I'd tried to make changes in my life, but I could never string together more than 4 days sobriety. Like, I'd literally have to isolate myself at the lake with no friends and white knuckle it, like, you know. I was always very high functioning. Like, I always got my work done. I worked a lot. I did restaurant work, you know, 12, 14 hours a day, but always under the haze of the depressant called alcohol, right? So a steady stream of depressant day in, day out, month after month, year after year. I ended up at 47 years old. Inside of a beautiful company, serving terrific food, surrounded by terrific people, the most miserable person sitting at the top of the pyramid of the restaurant, right? Yeah. So I took the help that was offered to me. I learned an enormous amount of things in rehab. I went to Chatsworth Rehabilitation Center locally here in Montreal. I learned about alcoholism. I learned about the 12 steps, which I knew nothing about. I learned about codependency. I learned about traumatic events in my life that might have, you know, put me in an area that might be sensitive to, you know, abusing alcohol or abusing a medicator. So once I figured all of these things, it was just clear to me, you know, very clear to me that I could work, you know, that I had a problem and that I could get through it. And I took a little bit of time off. I sought counsel with my friend Ryan Gray, who worked at a restaurant and is a sommelier who buys wine sober. And I spent a little bit of time with him in his restaurant, a restaurant not one of mine, his, you know, just to get my legs back, right? I did the pass. I put on an apron. I dispatched food all night for about a month. I did my 12 hours of hard kitchen labor. I drank bottled water. I went home exhausted at 11 p.m. I found the bottom of Netflix. And I got my confidence back to be able to go back to my restaurants, right?
Yeah.
Once I was in, and I went back to my restaurants, and today I can say that you and people can come, and I encourage overeating and I encourage celebratory drinking. I just realized that I'm one of the people that historically does not drink alcohol responsibly. Right. Yeah. So now that I know that, and now that I'm surrounded by, you know, people, and I, you know, I partake in meetings and I have a tight knit group of sober people around me, I can participate and enjoy this this gift I've been given, really.
We'll be back with more from restaurateur Dave McMillan of Joe Beef about how he learned to be back in his restaurants after he became sober. And if you are dealing with substance use disorder, please know it's not about willpower, it's an illness. And if you're in crisis or just need someone to talk with, you can find trained counselors 24 hours a day at the crisis text line. Text the message to 741-741 or call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. They're there to text or talk for free whenever you need. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're hearing personal stories today about mental health and food, and we've been talking to Dave McMillan, chef owner of Joe Beef Restaurant in Montreal, about his journey to sobriety. When we left off, Dave had gotten help to deal with his substance abuse, and now he talks to us about how his restaurant community responded to his sobriety and the challenges of supporting mental health in the industry.
One of them. Most interesting things that happened, I'd say, after my participation in sobriety, I would say maybe 16 weeks into it, people around me and inside my peer group and inside the restaurants started seeking me out. I started getting direct messages from my peers. I started having people text me wanting to have a coffee with me. I started realizing that a lot of people in the industry were kind of living what I was living in a parallel way, right? So I noticed that if I was the Viking leader of Joe Beef Restaurant and I drank out of magnums every night and I ate and I drank with the people and I celebrated daily, that I was setting that precedent and that example inside of my business to the young cooks that look up to me, follow me, and work for me.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
And as I walked away from that, and as I walked back to the fish market, as I walked back to the farms, as I walked back into the forest to go foraging for mushrooms again, starting to do sober man's activities, as I started loving the restaurant industry again and these beautiful businesses that I've built, there was a general come to the light across the company. I noticed staff drinking went down in all the restaurants across the board, like noticeably, you know.
Oh, interesting.
People started opting out of the glass of wine at the end of their shift or the beer for kombucha or nothing at all.
Wow.
That people were texting me, they wanted to go fishing with me now. They wanted to go mushroom picking with me. They wanted to know information that I had. They would go home early as I did. They would wake up early as I did and ask, can I go to the fish market with you? Can I go to the airport and pick up mushrooms with you? Can I come to the lake with you? And can you show me which mushrooms are good to eat and which aren't? Can I go picking ramps with you? Can I go to the lamb farm with you this weekend? Can I go see the beef guy? Like, you know, all of this started happening. So as the leader at the top of the pyramid gets sober, it seems that there was a general feeling of wellness across the company. And if you look at it, and other people have reached out to me, you could apply it to many other businesses, right? The culture of a business, not just a restaurant business, but any other business might just be defined by he who is the appointed leader, right?
Yeah. I do want to ask, though, in what ways has it been hard to be back in the industry and back in the restaurant? Because I think about it, too, because you have a new book that's out. Came out a few months ago. And you guys are hilarious. The Joe Beef guys are known to be hilarious. So the fact that it's a cookbook called Surviving the Apocalypse, you know, and I thought it was just a joke, but so much of the book, now knowing this, is about getting away from the restaurant.
Absolutely. I look back at that book somehow, and it was, you know, it's a funny book. It's interesting. It was put together possibly in the height of my darkest alcoholism. Mm. And there's a plea in that book somewhere, just in the name of the title and the direction, or how we even pitched the book, was somehow like escapism. We were already, when we were pitching that book, exhausted, fed up. The book was about not being at the restaurant. It was right. about everything against the restaurant. It was about the end is coming. It was about let's go to the cottage. Let's be close with our families. It was like an anti-restaurant book that we pitched.
Mm-hmm.
We made damn sure that if we're going to work on this book, that it's going to be all stuff that doesn't chain us to a six-burner stove next to a deep fryer underneath neon lights, right? In a white-tiled room. Kitchens can feel like insane asylums really quickly, right? I don't know if I'd write or if I'd pitch Surviving the Apocalypse right now. I might pitch something more joyous, you know?
More salads, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Avocado toast book.
But what has been hard about staying sober? Were there people who, you know, push back on you for changing, who want, quote, the old Dave back? I mean, how do you deal with that kind of thing?
You know, I have to say that people are amazing. I think that my friends who drink, you know, well, are fine with it. As long as I don't preach to them or try to recruit them into my program, they're all good with it. I can sit at the table with anybody and they can drink as much as they want. I just don't drink.
Yeah.
Eventually, it's strange for 2 minutes at the beginning because people don't know if they should be drinking around me or not. And I'm saying, like, please, you know, I just break the ice. I go, listen, drink your face off. I'll make sure you get home okay. You know, the jokes are just as funny. If anything, I'm just sharper and I don't repeat myself. So I enjoy it. But I do feel when it comes to my peers, when it comes to line cooks like myself, right, I kind of sometimes wish that I could have drank a bottle of Jura wine with a line cook, right,
mm-hmm.
That came all the way from San Francisco, that came all the way from Florida or Paris or London, right? But I get over it quickly because I look back at it and I said, I've had more years not sober than sober. And this year has been just a wonderful year. I've been very content and happy. I've attained all the goals that I wanted to in this year. And I feel that I'm in love with, food and wine again, right?
Yeah.
Not that I drink wine, but I'm in love with the geography of wine, the history of wine, the organic viticulture of wine. We have a couple of wine businesses as well, which I'm excited about the sales aspect of the wine, right? I'm excited about inventory management. I'm excited about the wellness, actually, the happiness of the kitchen crews that we oversee. When I was selfish in my addiction and my alcoholism, I paid less attention to the mental health of the 10 boys and girls working in any said kitchen, mm-hmm. right? Because I was selfish. I was more about me and my drinking. What am I doing? Whereas today, when that taken away from me, that selfishness is gone, I am more concerned about how is the kitchen doing? How are the boys and girls doing on the line tonight? Was it a difficult service? So the same amount of vigor and work that I put into drinking and celebrating, I put into other things now, right? I put into running that restaurant well.
Yeah.
Right. And I've had a lot of fun doing it. And to be in love with the restaurant business again, something that I thought was killing me,
yeah.
to actually, in fact, find out that it was a disease, alcoholism, that was killing me, has made it so much more fun to actually realize, to walk out of rehab and realize that I have this wonderful company of 6 restaurants that are just fun places to be at, full of dynamic, amazing people.
Yeah. What thoughts do you have, though, for someone who might still be struggling, though, with...
It's so dark. We've set up inside the restaurant now a meeting on Sunday nights at one of our restaurants that is kind of like an AA meeting. It's 4 people in the restaurant industry in our peer group that want to become sober or are sober, to talk really about restaurant experiences and triggers and the nightlife and how to navigate, the marketing of alcohol, being the marketer of alcohol,
right?
All of those things. But I'm very, very aware that there are a lot of people that have issues, And when I look back at how unhappy I was, I really, really want to help, people. It's a slippery slope. It's hard to help people unless they want to help themselves.
Sure.
So, it's like I have a list of people that I have an eye on, And that know that when they're done and then they want to come in from the cold, I'll have a warm jacket for them. I also understand one thing, which is because of who I am, I had a rehabilitation of privilege, right?
Right.
I had many managers on my payroll help me to go to a very good, very expensive rehabilitation program,
mm-hmm.
Spending money on therapy on a weekly basis to see good therapists who understand addiction counseling is not inexpensive. Also, because I have no fixed job, I'm not holding a salad station or I'm in charge of a halibut tonight, I can take the time to do the work that I need to do to stay sober. So when I see young people struggling in the kitchen that are not paid very much money, that can't take a week off to seek therapy, that can't afford therapy and can't even afford rehab. And then once they actually go to rehab, they can't even afford to pay the month rent, their cell phone bill, their electricity bill, taking 30 days off from your life has
impossible
costly implications.
Yeah.
Exactly. For a lot of people, it's impossible, especially young line cooks. So that's something that's been bothering me a lot. I've spoken inside of my peer group with my restaurant friends. I said, it's funny because we raise so much money for so many different charities. But I said, when it came time to actually having to help employees not only of my own restaurants, but my friends' restaurants, there's no funds available, zero, right? But, we probably participated in raising over $2 million for various charities last year. But I can't scrape together, $3,000 to send, 30 kids for 1 hour of therapy, right? So we're working on that. We're working on setting up a big dinner and a charity and having money available to be able to assist young people.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you kindly for having me.
Dave McMillan is a chef owner of Joe Beef in Montreal and the author, with Frederick Moran and Meredith Erickson, of Joe Beef, Surviving the Apocalypse. And if you are experiencing substance use disorder or another mental health condition and want help, you can find resources at splendidtable.org/mental health. Eating disorders are profoundly hard to deal with. Right? For people who experience them, eating disorders can feel like they're taking over their lives, and the pain is compounded by the fact that all the while, people often feel judged and shamed for having them. I'll be honest, I used to think they were basically just diets gone wrong until I learned that someone I loved had bulimia. And then she taught me that her world was filled with people telling her what to do, demanding that she fix herself, and I saw that no one ever really tried to listen to her. And it was as if people thought this illness was something she could just snap out of, which is not at all how it works. A little while back, the BBC show The Food Chain had a powerful episode on eating disorders, specifically on how they affect Black communities. We wanted to share this piece from that show, where the host Emily Thomas interviews the writer Stephanie Covington Armstrong on living with bulimia.
I always had kind of a wonky relationship with food because we grew up poor and food insecure and there wasn't always enough to eat. And so I had a lot of guilt around overeating.
Stephanie Covington Armstrong is a playwright and screenwriter and author of Not All Black Girls Know How to Eat, an account of how she suffered from bulimia during her teenage years after being raped when she was 12.
Bulimia kind of became its own kind of devil I could not outrun. And I couldn't, it's like a treadmill I couldn't get off. I would just gorge and binge and throw up and go to the gym. I would do that until I was exhausted and my eyes were bloodshot.
For years, Stephanie kept her eating disorder secret.
I mean, I had my family found out I was throwing up, and I was staying with my sister, and she confronted me. And rather than talk about my eating disorder, I started talking about my childhood rape. Like, that was less provocative and upsetting, and less. That made me feel less vulnerable than talking about my eating disorder. You know, I always heard things like, well, you know, Black women don't have eating disorders. Black women are incredibly comfortable with being large. Black women are, you know, so I just felt like I was failing all the way around, failing at being the archetype strong Black woman.
So Stephanie suffered in silence. Until one day, on the New York subway, she spotted an ad in the back of a local newspaper.
And it said, if you have an eating disorder, we can help you. And I just remember clutching onto this magazine and thinking this had to be the answer. And so I went to this guinea pig program. It was at one of the larger hospitals. And I felt like a freak. People were just staring at me and, you know, because what I've since learned is that women of color don't tend to come forward. And, you know, it just didn't work. I felt it was another experience where I just felt isolated, right? I felt like the only Black woman in the world who didn't know how to eat.
Eventually, Stephanie found a support program which helped her recover. But she says accepting help didn't come easily.
I come from a very proud community who like to keep our secrets and our issues to ourselves. It's like you don't share what's happening in your household with the outside world. And you certainly don't share it with white people. You know, that's kind of a betrayal. And so you learn how to cope on your own. I always say, why are we one of the only communities that have to struggle in silence, that have to, you know, suffer as if it's some badge of courage?
Where does this attitude to mental health come from, do you think?
I think it's just like a holdover from slavery. It's like you're going to go out into the world and trust white people. You know, when you look at these people of color who have trusted the system and been burned, I think it's well deserved, this lack of trust.
Do you think that eating disorders are still seen as a white woman's problem? Or do you think perceptions have changed?
Eating disorders are seen as a white woman's problem. They're seen as a gateway to wanting to be white. They're seen as black women who want to be mainstream or who want to be skinny. They're not seen as a mental health issue. They're not seen as a coping mechanism. And I thought, if I wrote a book and helped one person understand all people, men, women, who deal with stress, may develop an unhealthy relationship with food. So I wrote my book. The response was not what I expected. What I found initially was it was lesbian women, white, poor women, all kinds of ethnic women. But it took a while for the black community to kind of embrace me in the same way.
And why was that, do you think?
You know, it's a shameful thing. We don't want to talk about the molester uncle. We don't want to talk about things in our community that don't bring us pride. Like, we still have one or two or three black women speaking for the entire community. And that is problematical, except somebody has to speak.
Why are there so few women speaking?
I mean, it's certainly not sexy, right? Like, yeah, I want to talk about throwing up. Like, it, you know, you kind of lose all your black girl magic when that's where your conversation. It's just less, people are less interested.
Stephanie Covington Armstrong is a playwright, screenwriter, and author of Not All Black Girls Know How to Eat. That piece was from the BBC's Food Chain with Emily Thomas. And if you or someone you know is living with an eating disorder, there is help and support. You can find resources at splendidtable.org/mental health. And coming up, body image activist Virgie Tovar. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We've devoted our entire episode today to food and mental health. People have generously shared their stories over the hour, and now we're turning to Virgie Tovar. She's a body image activist who says that what she does isn't about food, but about human rights. And she's here with us to talk about what that means for mental health. Virgie!
Francis!
Thank you so much for talking with us. I'm really excited to talk with you. And I want to start actually with telling you a little bit about like my happy place, right?
Yes.
So I love going to restaurants. My wife and daughter are going away in a couple weeks, and I'm going to be sad to miss them. But honestly, I just keep thinking, like, where am I going to go for dinner by myself? Like, I can't wait to go. Seriously, like, it really is. Like, for me, like, restaurants are, like, warm and they're inviting. And I really feel, like, happy when I'm in a restaurant. Like, I'll just be sitting at a bar, having an appetizer, and just feeling like, this is great. So it was really eye-opening for me when you made me realize that for a lot of people, going to restaurants is not that. It's, you know, actually can be a really stressful experience. So can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I mean, so I think a lot about restaurants in terms of access because I am a bigger person. And so there's a lot of dimensions and thought that go into a regular experience, like going into a restaurant, which for many people really is just kind of a joyful experience. For me, it sort of starts even before I even get to the restaurant. So I'm thinking about how much space is there in the waiting area where the line is, and am I going to be in the way? I think about my favorite coffee place, and there's this very narrow area, and it always gives me this little hit of anxiety. And then I think about, so what am I going to order? And am I going to have to worry about the people within earshot judging me? Am I going to have to worry about the cashier thinking some kind of way? So, and am I going to, for instance, get the whipped cream on the coffee that I like so much because they make it in-house? Mm-hmm. Am I going to get that hit of, oh, she's bigger, so she shouldn't be getting whipped cream on her coffee? And then there's kind of this other dimension of, am I going to sit and eat the thing or drink the thing? Because eating in public is really vulnerable when you're a bigger bodied person, I think, especially if you're a woman. And then there's the dimension of the seating. Am I going to be able to fit in the chair, number one? And more importantly, perhaps, am I going to be able to sit there comfortably to actually enjoy the thing? And so there's kind of all of these different components that go into it that are sort of hidden, but that are very real and very layered in the mind of someone like me.
That's so interesting. And we, even in the food industry, we always talk about, like, it's welcoming. It's about bringing people to the table. And it's like, oh, no, you literally did not make a table that many, many people who would otherwise be happy to come there, you know, feel comfortable sitting in.
Yeah. I live in San Francisco, and it's a very design-conscious city. And minimalism is kind of the height of design here at this in this moment. And I don't know, I think a lot of people find minimalist seating, for instance, to be quite uncomfortable. But for me, there it's physical discomfort, but it's also there's like a mental health hit that happens because I'm used to sort of walking into a restaurant and thinking, oh, especially in a city like San Francisco, this place is not for me. This place is for very thin foodies. And so that tiny chair feeds into a narrative that I don't belong. And that's a narrative that I've been taught for a very long time, ever since I was a child.
Yeah. What other, like, basic things do thin people, or this is a term you taught me, straight-sized people, take for granted?
Yeah, I've been thinking so much about this. I've always been fat, so it's hard for me to have perspective. There are moments of realization where it just blows my mind. Like, for instance, someone had to explain to me that that thin people think that fat people are fat because we have this obscenely different lifestyle than thin people do. That we just eat significantly more and move significantly less than all thin people. And essentially, this is not data supported. You know, I can say, as someone who's researched this for a decade, this is not supported by data. And she sort of had to sit and explain it about five or six times for me to be able to understand that, oh, the data don't matter. What matters is that, you know, this is a discriminatory belief. This is like a victim blaming belief. And it doesn't make any sense because it doesn't make any sense. But, you know, a lot of thin people have been taught not to be friends with fat people. So if you don't have any fat friends, you don't know what our life looks like. And then on top of that, there's kind of this confirmation bias where we kind of discard information that goes against whatever deep-seated belief we have.
Sure.
And we kind of lean in very hard to information that confirms what we believe.
Sure.
And so there's multiple effects going on there, like multiple things that are creating the reality and perception of others. But that was a big one. I think another one that I'm thinking of, this is sort of a more recent sort of area of research that I've been looking into. The efficacy of important medications is not tested above a certain weight. And this, it was sort of made really international news. I think it was last year when they found out that a very popular form of emergency contraception in Europe lost efficacy at, I think it was 165 pounds and was completely useless, I think above 170 pounds.
Oh, God.
And to give context, I mean, this is Europe for sure, but like to give context in the United States, 68% of American women are a size 14 or above, meaning that they're sort of at that level.
Oh, my
and,
God.
And I think like another example is access to even fashion. in, you know, like having clothing available to you that makes you feel good, that makes you feel seen. And for a lot of people, a lot of plus size people, going into a store is a very stressful experience. It's a very stigmatizing experience, a very shameful experience. And so there's this real disempowerment that's built into fatphobic discrimination.
Tell me what that kind of stress does to people.
Yes. Yeah, so there is this phenomenon known as minority stress, and it's actually a body of research that looks at the cumulative effect of discrimination and sort of quantifies the physiological effects of stress among people who are marginalized, and that includes fat people. You know, stress, especially ongoing stress, affects the function of the heart. It affects the immune system. These are the issues that are connected with higher weight. And what minority stress theory is kind of attempting to posit is that it's actually typically the experience of discrimination that leads to negative health outcomes in people who are discriminated against and marginalized people. So a paper actually came out in 2015 that I thought pretty firmly posited that weight discrimination could lead to shortened life expectancy in higher weight people. And stress manifests in a lot of different ways. I want to talk about this thing called hypervigilance, sort of this constant state of awareness of how others are perceiving you, of attempting to kind of offset those things. It's about doing a lot of mental work around a really mental Olympics to try and prevent experiences of discrimination and or always being prepared for those moments. So when you're a fat person in our culture, where it is still socially acceptable to overtly express fat negative views, I certainly think that that is changing rapidly. We are constantly anticipating cruelty and negativity. And, you know, I think, again, increasingly there's less overt fatphobia happening in media and maybe even in social interactions in certain places. But they're still happening, and you never quite know when it's going to hit.
Right.
And when that moment hits, it is so utterly dehumanizing. It's so humiliating. And I think that it's that humiliation component that can be so deeply painful. Because, right, and the humiliation comes from the fact that you know you're living in a culture that corroborates this cruelty.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because it is about a culture. It's about a society. So what do you say to the arguments then that, you know, even if you're being pressured to be thin, well, isn't it better to be that way because it's, quote, healthier for you?
There's so much to say to that. I mean, I want to talk about, you know, the way that fat phobia taxes all of us, but the ways in which it kind of really does as you get larger in this culture, the way that that tax gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Do we have time to talk about this for a second?
Sure.
Let's do it. Okay, then I'm going to address this concern about health. So it's useful to look at a type of discrimination like fat phobia with a three-dimensional lens. So the first dimension I often talk about is the intrapersonal dimension. So this is how a person feels about themselves and their body. And when we're talking about this level, this is where we are seeing a lot of suffering and anguish, regardless of size. That moment in the mirror that accumulates into hundreds of thousands of moments over a lifetime. And then we look at the second dimension, which is the interpersonal. This is the relational and social dimension. So we know, for instance, that many employers have bias against plus size candidates. We know that doctors tend to judge fat patients more harshly. And we know that dating is harder for fat people. So that those are all things that are happening between people, and that's the interpersonal. And then there's the third dimension, which is the institutional dimension. And this is sort of the outside of human exchange dimension. It has to do with institutions, industries, the world in which you are living. Are these systems, are institutions accessible to you or not? And this includes something like education, right? Like the size of seating in classrooms, the size of seating in lecture halls. This includes access to fashion, what I was talking about earlier. So the fashion industry has long neglected the 68% of American women who are a size 14 or above. And then again, that efficacy of medication not being tested above a certain weight.
Yeah.
These are all things that are above the intra and the inter, and make up the world that we're all navigating.
Sure.
And so when we're talking about the second and third dimension, the higher your weight, the more you're getting hit on both of those. And so this is how we create dimensionality around understanding how this issue affects people across the size spectrum. Yeah. And in terms of health, I mean, this is really interesting, right? Like in our culture, there is a false correlation between food, exercise, and body size. Mm. Most people who are thin are genetically predisposed towards having a smaller body. There are many, many, many fat people who exercise and eat vegan or any number of, you know, vegetable-based diets or what we would consider like nutritious diets,
sure,
and are still fat. And I think, you know, the fact that we don't see this speaks to a lot of things, right? Like it speaks to confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. It speaks to the lack of representation of fat people. It speaks to the ways in which thin people aren't having meaningful relationships with fat people, generally speaking, because of the fear of being stigmatized through proximity. I mean, really, our attitudes, and I can say this with complete confidence, our attitudes towards body size are archaic and they're not data informed. And discrimination really does become the area where we as a culture, and any culture, begins to have blind spots, begins to cherry pick data, begins mm-hmm. to sort of like, you know, delete certain things and lean into others. And the truth is we need to accept that the current paradigm around how we understand health, how we understand food, how we understand size is not working. We need to stop worrying and wondering and questioning why people are the size that they are. Because at the end of the day, every single person deserves respect, care, love, proper medical care, full humanity, no matter what size they are or why they are that size.
Thank you so much, Virgie.
Yeah, of course.
That is activist and author Virgie Tovar. Her latest book is You Have the Right to Remain Fat, and she's working on a new one called Flawless. You can find a whole lot more about Virgie and her numerous projects at splendidtable.org. And there's also a resource list she created for anyone interested in positive body image or wanting help and support. And that is our show for the week. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you found something here that helped you or helped you understand someone else's experience in a new way. And before we go, I also want to tell you about the latest episode of our podcast, Splendid Table Select. It's another conversation that's part of our mental health programming this month, and it's with Dr. Drew Ramsey, a nutritional psychiatrist and farmer who talks about the connections between what and how we eat, brain function, and mental health.
Years ago, as I was giving more public speeches about food, I sort of promised myself that I'd use the word suicide and use the word depression in every talk. I was really nervous about that back then. And what I found is that everybody meets my gaze in those moments, that everybody knows what we're talking about. Everybody's having this conversation, is concerned about their mental health. So I do believe it's a way for us to start thinking about mental health as brain health, that we're feeding your brain. And as we think about brain health and what we can all do to improve our brain health and improve our emotional health, I feel that we begin to take on the mental health epidemic together. And that's really the only way that we're going to defeat it, is if we talk about these conditions, if we properly diagnose and properly treat them. And I believe this new part is we empower patients. One of the things I like about food is the fun that it brings into the clinical room for me. I mean, it's really a gas to hear about what people eat, how they eat, their favorite foods, the little habits they don't tell people. And then it's such an intimate way to know someone and influence them, to partner with them and think about really how they nourish themselves in the most granular way with what they eat.
You can find that conversation with Dr. Drew Ramsey in your Splendid Table podcast queue or at splendidtable.org. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and this episode is part of a collaborative partnership with our colleagues at Call to Mind, an initiative from American Public Media to foster new conversations about mental health. You can learn more at calltomindnow.org. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell, Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director, Erica Romero is our associate producer, Chip Walton is our digital producer, Sally Swift is our managing producer. Special thanks this week to the BBC's Food Chain, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.